We need more work on idea transfer, but I stick to my claim that this will occur and needs to occur to help developing countries face the serious challenges their cities confront.
Welcome to the last of our VoxDev talks that are based on the BREAD IGC virtual PhD level course in economics. It took place online between September and November 2024. My name is Tim Phillips. Today we're focusing on sustainable urbanisation. How can cities adapt in the face of climate change, both the people in the cities and the buildings? Matthew Kahn of USC and Shiki Sheng of MIT gave the lecture, and they both join me now. Matt, welcome.
It's great to be here.
And Shiki, welcome as well.
Hello, everyone.
Matt, when we think about how people adapt to climate change in cities, what do we mean by that?
When it's extremely hot, or if a natural disaster occurs, of course we suffer, but can next time be different? That Who song, "We Won't Be Fooled Again." So with cumulative experience, or if we expect that Mother Nature is punching us harder, what steps do we take such that we suffer less when we do get shocked? And so by adaptation, I mean almost being in a defensive crouch such that either the punch misses or it hurts less when it hits me on the jaw.
Shiki, when we're talking about how real estate can adapt, what do we mean by that?
So as Matt mentioned, this Mother Nature, and clearly these kinds of risks like hurricanes, flooding, wildfire, they are very location-based. And real estate also location-based. They are buildings fixed to some locations. So naturally, these two things are bundled together, which means the real estate, they are in some locations. If they are vulnerable to those kinds of risks, you need to make the decision whether you move people out and away from those locations and abandon those real estate, or you do something on the buildings and make those buildings more resilient.
So let's talk about people, first of all. So Matt, imagine that I am a policymaker. I'm in a city somewhere in a low middle income country. I think that the research shows I could expect more people will want to migrate to my city because of climate change. Should I be trying to manage this process?
Absolutely. Now, there's a question what we mean by manage. Leo Feeler and Vernon Henderson wrote a fascinating paper in Brazil that mayors in some cities in Brazil, anticipating that rural people are moving to their city, didn't connect the slums to the water system as sort of a poison pill defense to discourage them from moving. So,
gosh,
to say something provocative, a mayor who's aware that climate change is accelerating rural to urban migration has two different strategies, almost like a poker player. One is to play nice and to get ready for this migration. Another is to repel this group by making quality of life in the slums worse. And at least in the Brazil case, Henderson documented that. So to answer your question, I'd like to live in a world where mayors in the developing world anticipate this migration and take proactive steps to facilitate this migration. But we're sometimes seeing, in some nations in the developing world, mayors anticipating the migration and almost putting up walls to deflect these migrants to other places.
Wow. Well, let's look on the bright side. Let's say that I'm going to play nice. What's fair or what's successful in the sort of policies that I could use?
Think of 24 hours in your day. You wake up somewhere. What is the quality of your housing? You need clean water and electricity to get through that day. What infrastructure's in place if the city's growing bigger? You need transportation modes to get to work and to shop and see friends. What is the transportation grid in that city? So in the case of electricity, water access, and transport, the basic infrastructure grid of providing it and financing it such that migration of rural people to the cities doesn't congest the city and scale up the social costs of cities, or what Glaser calls the demons of density. Of rural people are moving to cities because of climate change, and I'd love to see them thrive. But we face this challenge of the demons of density. If we anticipate that challenge, how wise leaders accommodate this growth such that their city thrives during a time of climate change.
Yeah, if we take Brazil as the example, you see São Paulo, it's an enormous city. It's attracting a lot of migration. It's a huge sprawling place at the moment. But at least if you're doing adaptation work there, you can do it at scale. You can focus on that. Is this the best strategy, or should people be migrating to lots of smaller cities?
So this is a great research question, and I know that I don't fully know the answer. So in my teaching at USC, I discussed that the United States has 300 major cities. Mm. For my friends in Bangladesh, they point to Dhaka, but say that Bangladesh has not developed a system of cities. So I'm going to answer your question with a question. I'm like the Riddler from Batman. In developing nations that have a system of cities that don't just have one dominant city, I think they have a better chance to adapt to climate change because of competition between cities and giving people a menu of choices, like at a Chinese restaurant, of what is right for them.
Another optimistic way to look at this is the process of development helps the process of adaptation. I'm saying that. Is it true? As we get richer, do we get better at adapting in cities?
So this is one of my core claims. And the reason is, I want to be clear about how we get richer. It's not that we're winning the lottery. Most of our income growth comes from our investment in human capital and skill. And a point throughout the IGC lectures is this complementarity between cities and skills. When we expect to live our lives in cities, our parents invest more in our skills and we invest more in our skills. And so my argument that with economic development and with personal flourishing, that we have an increased capacity to adapt, is it's not just that we're richer and can afford an air conditioner, but we've invested in the skills such that we have the wits and the interest and the imagination to adapt to the new scenarios that we never anticipated that climate change is now posing.
Now, I jumped straight in there, and when I assumed the job of policymaker, I also assumed the responsibility for adaptation. That's very often our mental model, how we think of it. And policymakers the world over in low middle income country cities are under pressure to do what they can. Now, by responding to that, is there a potential that they might do too much and crowd out the sort of activity that could also help to solve the problem?
So we see this. There's a new paper by Alan Chow of Stanford set in Jakarta, Indonesia.
Oh, yes.
So in Indonesia, let me set it up like this. Jakarta faces sea level rise, and the government and the capital city, there's great investment in protecting Jakarta. An old Chicago economist like me asks, is an unintended consequence of boosting a place that crowds out private self-protection? And so to say that without jargon, if Matthew thinks that Miami is safe, if Alan thinks that Jakarta is safe because of government investment in seawalls and infrastructure, do I move there when I wouldn't have moved to those at-risk places if the government hadn't protected the place? So when government bubble wraps a place, and that was a half joke, do people invest less in their own self-protection if they perceive that they're safe? And this requires a lot more research. So this crowding out hypothesis is a sexy economics idea, but it needs to be tested in every setting. Because I'd love to live in a world where government efforts are a complement to private self-protection, not a substitute. And one of the themes in my lecture was we need to study this over and over again in every context.
When we're talking about migration as well, something that comes up over and over again is the value of just giving people good information so they can make good choices. What's going to be at the other end when they migrate to a city? What sort of information could we give to migrants to cities, and how much effect would that have?
Rob Metcalf, Sebastian, Daryl Fairweather, and I just released a United States paper, an optimistic paper. We used the internet platform Redfin, and Redfin ran a field experiment where it provided trusted flood risk information from the First Street Foundation. And we found that when you provide flood risk information to people searching for housing, those who had been searching for housing in risky places substituted and searched for housing in safer areas and bid less in dollars for housing that was risky. So in the developing world, I think that climate science is going to make progress identifying areas that face extreme heat and flood risk, and creating these report cards and publicizing these will help urbanites, before they make a sunk investment in housing, be aware of what they're buying. So sort of this buyer beware. Mm-hmm. I believe that people are adults and research their decisions, but that climate information can be costly to acquire. And so an educated consumer is more likely to make a good choice if they're aware of the risks. So that was a long-winded way of saying that more effective urbanization will occur in the developing world as rural to urban migrants are aware of the risks in the places that they're considering.
So, Shiki, imagine I'm still that policymaker. I'm feeling a little bit optimistic after talking to Matt. I have to turn to the buildings that are in my city. How much of the emissions and the energy use comes from those buildings?
So I always use this question or the statistics to motivate my teaching and my research. On average, 1/3 of the carbon emission and also energy use come from buildings. But that's on average. But if you look at San Francisco, if you look at New York City and Boston, for those very big cities and the high rise on buildings in downtown, about 70% to 80% of the energy use and carbon emission, they are from these commercial big buildings.
I've been talking to a Chicago economist like Matt, and that's made me think I don't really want to intervene in forcing through decarbonization if there is a good economic rationale for it. Can I make that argument to the developers and the owners and the tenants in my city that it is economically rational for them to do the investment in decarbonizing these buildings?
Matt and I, we are co-authors for like 2 decades. We published many papers, we are both very optimistic. We believe in the market. So the market incentives can really help move the needle and achieve the goals of sustainability. In terms of the question you asked, yes, in my lecture, I showed some evidence, a meta-analysis of many, many empirical studies. On average, they did show that if a building is a green building with a higher energy efficiency, all else equal, the green buildings always can claim a price premium, like 5%, 6%, 7%, and also a rent premium that can incentivize the owners invest money, the developers build those green buildings.
So as before, is there a problem that maybe the people that could take action don't know enough about what they could do and the returns to taking action? Would better information provision, do we think that that could help solve these problems?
Exactly. Although all the empirical studies done by me, Matt, and other scholars, they show that on average, there are some green premiums, but that's on average, this wide distribution. In some cases, in some cities, and especially for the very immature markets, they sometimes you couldn't observe at all the zero premium. And sometimes you only observe a cost premium because, of course, you need to invest more money, but you couldn't really see the price premium. So that basically posed a very big challenge to the private sector. So then the information thing pops up because information is very important. The buildings always is an information asymmetry, right? For the buyers, for the buyers before really living in that building for some time, and it's very hard to tell the quality of the building, the energy efficiency, the comfort level, etc. So that's why now you saw all these green building certificates, LEED, Energy Star, I think in UK called Green, and some other names in other countries. So that's really public goods can provide such an information for common people, even if they don't understand much of the details, but when they see LEED, this LEED certified, they understand that energy efficiency. And also I want to use an example that I did when I was in China. As a professor, I did a survey. I went to some communities and many people, they didn't understand what does green building mean, what's the benefit we can gain from that. And then we cannot show an information card to them. Say, according to scientific research, whatever. And the green buildings, they have this, that benefit. You have lower energy bills. You have better indoor air quality. Then we ask again. And they immediately, they understood more and their willingness to pay for green buildings really significantly increased.
Always, when we're talking about climate change, we run into the problem that sometimes the people who are making the investments aren't necessarily the ones who benefit from those investments. Do we have that same problem in real estate, that our incentives aren't aligned?
Yes, you also asked a very good question. We call it split incentive. Mm-hmm. So the information asymmetry is one market failure and a split incentive is another one. So especially in this landlord and tenants, this relationship. For example, like imagine an office building. Now they always have the triple net lease. The triple net lease means tenants pay for all the energy bills. Mm-hmm. And the landlord only cover the energy in the hallway, elevator, all those common areas. And think about that. If a very old building, then maybe it makes sense for the entire building to do a retrofit. However, then the tenants will be the free riders. After retrofit, they have lower energy bills. But because they are temporary users, right? They don't want to invest money really to change the building. But the owners, they also don't want to do so, because if they invest money, they cannot recoup all the benefit, and all the benefit go to the tenants. So that's a pension. So then the way is a mechanism called green lease. The lease terms, they add in some new clauses. Say, oh, how to share the initial cost, how to share the benefit so that both parties are happy. Win-win solutions instead of win-lose solution. I think that now a lot of these landlord tenants, they are using green lease.
Now, as a policymaker, how confident can I be in this data, this information that I'm giving about the costs and the benefits of adapting real estate to cope with climate change, especially in a city in a low or middle income country where maybe the buildings are quite different to those in richer countries and maybe we haven't done as much measuring?
Actually, there's an advantage of a developing country in this, because think about United States, think about UK, London, and so many old buildings, because they very developed, then it's all the old buildings and like hundreds of years and past dependency. It's very hard to do a retrofit, even more expensive than tearing down and build a new one. However, that direction also doesn't make enough sense, because you may have a more energy efficient building, but when you tear and build a new one, you have more embodied carbon, because you need more concrete, you need more steel like that. And for a developing country and the cities, they are relatively new and they have a lot of new construction. So they have a better opportunity to change. And if they make the right decision, and then they have better and more energy efficient new buildings because they're expanding so much. And then that can last for 50, 100 years. But of course, they may not have enough resources. So that's basically need to think about how they can really leverage your private market, right? Not just a government give money, but also the private market to use, just now we mentioned, some market mechanisms so that the developers are willing to pay for that.
Previously in this series, I've had conversations with Ed Laser, Vernon Henderson. One thing that they both mentioned is that we know a great deal more about cities like London and Paris and New York than we do about cities in Africa and developing Asia. How applicable do you think that research is going to be in the future? How much new research and experimentation do we need, Matt?
This is a great question. When graduate students present their seminars, there's always this question of, can we extrapolate from one setting to another? Mm-hmm. And I sit there as the old guy in the room and I scratch my head. And so there are certain ideas, the demons of density. New York City had great deaths from cholera in the early 20th century. So certain lessons the developing world can learn from the US and European experience, but some lessons will have to be relearned the hard way. And so I think that's what makes it such an exciting time to study urban development, because these aren't laws of physics. Correlations we see in American cities don't necessarily have to transplant to Africa cities. And so we need more work here. And that was what was so exciting, to have hundreds of young people attend our lecture. That was very exciting for an old guy like me.
Yes.
When you're looking at this, do you feel that there are a lot of open questions, interesting open questions?
Yes, definitely. So in the last 3, 4, 5 years, I did see a big change, maybe because of the regulations, but also because of the demand from the capital market and the consumers. So now the real estate and the urban like developers, all these real estate players, they are under much more pressure to change. That's why at first we didn't teach this in our classroom. You know, 3 years ago, we said we must create a new class to teach the future leaders, whatever the academic and practitioners, about sustainability, because it's very urgent. And then the industry said, oh, we really face this, and the Boston and the New York City, they just impose such regulations on our building energy efficiency, and we will face penalty. Please tell us how to do. And basically, they have a lot of open questions, but it's a lot to our scholars to address, to answer those exciting questions. Now the data is more and more available, so we can try to explore those very, very interesting questions. But some research projects we are doing now here using US data, and it's very hard to do that, to replicate or to do similar research, because of data availability. I think there's a long way to go.
But CG, let me pick up and ask you a question. So you were just in Vietnam. When you met with these individuals in Vietnam, were you impressed with their data? Were they learning from the China and Western experience in our cities?
Yes. So I Vietnam for the first time. This past summer, I went to Hanoi, the capital city, because Matt and I, we have a joint project there. So I talked to industry people, some academics. On one hand, it's true that now we have satellite data, we have big data and cell phone data. On the other hand, for their statistics, it's still like not very high quality. For example, the research I did in China, like real estate price and rent and land, those data, now that like traditionally, the statistics bureau data, not that easy to get. But I feel like now they can take advantage of the big data, machine learning, all those new techniques that when 20 years ago, when we did China research, we didn't have that.
We often talk about should economists collaborate with people from other disciplines in the social sciences. But here is there an argument to collaborate with engineers and technologists and innovators. They have experience of what's working and what isn't. And secondly, they can help you think about what is possible to do.
I love that. For example, Holland has ample experience with flood control.
Yeah.
It would interest me very much for cities in Africa facing flood risk. Has the Gates Foundation or someone sponsored conferences to bring African officials and business people and city boosters to visit Amsterdam and to learn about what Holland has done right and wrong cost effectively and to import those ideas to Africa's cities facing flood risk? Paul Romer, the Nobel laureate, talks about ideas as public goods. And part of my optimism about our adapting to climate change isn't based on magic, but it's based on learning from others' experience. We need more work on this idea transfer. But I stick to my claim that this will occur and needs to occur to help developing countries face the serious challenges their cities confront.
I share with Matt that this interdisciplinary collaboration very useful for this climate change or sustainability research. Everything here at MIT, I talked to engineers and I talked to climate scientists. Last week, we worked together. I feel like we need more conversation between disciplines and also the researchers and the practice so that we can benefit from each other.
I'd like an opinion from you on how urgent those challenges are.
Tim, I take this challenge, of course, very seriously. But as an eternal optimist, I argue that as more and more of us understand the challenge we face, we demand solutions by policymakers and by the next Bezos and Musk. An irony, the greater is the aggregate demand for solutions, the more optimistic I get about entrepreneurs delivering. I cracked the joke to my undergraduates. If I was the world's only bald man, we get no Rogaine. But if enough of us are bald, hypothetically, Tim, then there is a demand for products that solve this issue. Demand creates supply is part of my free market optimism about the ability of an urbanized world to step up and confront the very serious challenges we face.
I feel better after our conversation. So thank you very much. Thank you, Sheik.
Thank you so much.
And Matt as well.
Thank you.
The course is designed for PhD students and researchers in economics and related fields, but it's open to everyone. You can find out about it at igc.org. You can watch recordings of the lectures and you can download the slides and the reading lists as well. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes are at voxdev.org, and you will also find articles about the topics we feature.